That's why species reintroductions are so important. You know, if you can make alive for people the idea that there used to be white storks clattering their beaks and nesting on wagon wheels on virtually every village house roof, and then they were made extinct, but now we're bringing them back and the boxes are coming over from Germany and the birds are being released and it's on the BBC News and you can go and see them, suddenly people get very fired up that restoration is possible and that I'm part of this. And that's why rewilding is such an incredibly optimistic movement. I'd say that rewilding as a strand within the broader environmental movement has had by far the greatest success in mobilizing large numbers of people to the cause.
Welcome to Wild's podcast, Voices of Wilderness. Through the stories our guests share, you'll learn about how we can and must protect wilderness for a healthy future. We hope to leave you a little bit more inspired to speak out, take action, make a difference, and find solutions to the biodiversity and climate crises. Welcome to our special episode celebrating World Rewilding Day. Today, we're embarking on an interesting conversation between two passionate conservationists from opposite ends of the globe. Joining us are none other than Ben Goldsmith, an avid nature lover and dedicated advocate for rewilding, and Amy Lewis, Wild CEO. You'll notice that I take more of a backseat in today's episode to absorb, just like all of you, what Amy and Ben have to say. Together, they dive into the captivating realms of rewilding, storytelling, sustainable food systems, grassroots efforts, and much more. So let's jump right in, shall we? Well, hello, everyone. It is so exciting to be here. We have a really special episode today because we are sitting down with Ben and Amy. And I would like, you know, I'm just excited to be a fly on the wall for this conversation. First and foremost, please introduce yourselves and let us know a little bit about what you do. Amy, why don't you start?
Of course. My name's Amy Lewis. I am the CEO of Wild.org, which is a global conservation group. We work primarily on global policy solutions and building a global movement for the protection of wilderness, but we also have several on-the-ground projects protecting wild areas primarily through the initiative of local communities and indigenous peoples.
Wonderful. And Ben, how about you?
Well, first and foremost, I'm a fan of Wild, and I'm a modest contributor and a believer. I've been a passionate nature lover and I guess rewilder since I was a kid. Like I sent a letter at the age of 12 or 13 to Country Life, which is Britain's largest rural readership magazine, saying that they lack imagination on the subject of wild boar, which of course has been extinct in Britain for about 300 years, but thankfully, since I was a kid, has now started to make a comeback. Yeah, I'm a nature lover and rewilder, and I devote as much of my time as I can to this. I was a UK government advisor and a member of the board of the Environment Department of the government here for 5 years until 2022. I am a trustee of one of the UK's largest environmentally focused philanthropic foundations. I have a day job as well. I do green investment, kind of on the side, although I wouldn't tell my colleagues that.
Wonderful. Well, I can't wait to hear all of the thoughts that are going to be bouncing around during today's conversation. So Amy, why don't you hop in on with some of the questions that you had and just take it away, and I'll kind of interject when needed.
Great. Thank you so much, Jackie. It's always fun working with you on these podcasts. Ben, so one of the reasons why I was so excited about this interview with you is that there seems to be, I've been following your work a little bit for a while, and there seems to be some interesting overlap in your values and priorities and what we do at Wild, but there's also some interesting divergences too. And so I kind of wanted to probe both the overlaps and the differences and just learn more about you and the process. And really the entry point for me is Conservation Collective, I would love to know more about what that is and why you are a part of that group, what really has motivated you to get that up and going.
Yeah, so I love starting things. Like, I think that's what I'm good at. And I've started a bunch of things in my life. And one of them is this growing charity called the Conservation Collective. And I guess the fundamental problem that we're trying to address is that people don't tend to give of their time and their money to the environment as a priority. I mean, in the UK, when we started the Conservation Collective, we found that around somewhere between 2 and 3% of all philanthropic giving was being directed towards environmental work. So a tiny proportion, given the scale of the problem. And we figured that that's because environmental issues are often quite abstract for people who aren't immersed in them. They don't really know how they're going to make a difference. It feels distant from their lives. And so what we figured is if we could make it possible for people to give their time and their money towards environmental restoration in the place that they love, they'd be more likely to get involved. And so we set up a local environment foundation, as it happens, in the island of Ibiza, in the Balearic Islands of Spain. It's a place I've been to only 3 times, but it's absolutely beautiful and amazingly unspoiled, given its reputation as kind of a touristy sort of party island. Big, big percentage of that island is completely intact in a way. The wonderful Mediterranean maquis forest and a small-scale kind of patchwork quilt of almond groves and figs and olives and small-scale agriculture. The beaches are all very well protected in the north and the west. So I persuaded them to help set up a foundation, a bunch of friends who live there. And they today, through the Ibiza Preservation Foundation, are giving away about €1 million a year to local grassroots initiatives on that island. The Conservation Collective was formed to set up other foundations like it. So we now have 20 of those local environment foundations in places ranging from Devon in England to the Highlands and Islands of Scotland to Cyprus to Sicily, the Cyclades Islands of Greece, Barbados. And they're like little donor clubs where people commit to giving a bit of money and a bit of time. And then, of course, local businesses get in on the act. A lot of restaurants in the island of Ibiza now have €1 for every cover that comes on your bill that goes to the Ibiza Preservation Foundation. And I guess the second holy grail that the Conservation Collective seeks to address is to get money to the grassroots, because a lot of the most amazing, impactful things happen because of small groups of people or even just one person with a huge amount of passion, a huge amount of energy, and usually little or no funding. And they often therefore have a day job. You know, they're working as a marine biologist in the university, or they're working as a waiter or a lawyer, but they have a passion for some particular agenda. And if you give them a bit of money, they can print leaflets and get posters put up and organize people and build a movement, take time out of work and go and meet politicians and just get stuff done. So what the Conservation Collective is about is pooling relatively modest sums of money and distributing it to grassroots environmental restoration initiatives in each of the places where we have a foundation. And we funded stuff. We funded vulture reintroduction in Cyprus. I do a podcast, Rewilding the World podcast, just to illuminate some of the stories that I find the coolest that are happening around the world. And this morning I interviewed someone called Melpo from the BirdLife Office of Cyprus, who is overseeing the reintroduction of Griffon vultures to that island. That's the kind of stuff that doesn't cost much money. I mean, like, it's a few thousand euros to bring the vultures from Spain, and suddenly these birds are back after quite a long absence. So the Conservation Collective is really a philanthropic network, and it's working out pretty well.
There's a couple of tangents I want to go on just from that one answer alone. The first one, though, is what happened to the vulture population?
So I think in Cyprus, the issue has been poisoning. You have small mesopredators, foxes, for example. You have feral dogs, you have feral cats. And I don't think the vultures were the target of the poisoners, but it's typically hunters who don't want to compete for their quarry, which are kind of game birds that live on the island, and also migratory birds. Cyprus has a huge problem with the slaughter of migratory birds passing through each spring and each autumn. And BirdLife's principal mission is to reduce that annual or semi-annual slaughter, and they're having some pretty good results doing that. But a byproduct of this vibrant hunting community has been the poisoning inadvertently of vultures. So black vultures went extinct probably in the 1950s, and Griffon vultures were down to about 10 individuals last year. And so BirdLife has been bringing Griffon vultures from Spain with huge success. They have a 6-month acclimatization period, and then these videos of these boxes being opened and these massive birds kind of sauntering out and then looking at their surroundings and suddenly launching themselves off the cliffs is really quite something. And it's like headline news in Cyprus. So I think species reintroductions have a totemic role to play, because in order to do a species reintroduction, you need to get everyone ready for it and you need to get the habitat ready for it. So it becomes a huge sort of pan-societal effort, kind of a matter of huge public interest and a matter of public pride to bring these species back. And so inadvertently, I guess, they've tackled a whole range of environmental issues in the process of bringing these vultures back. And they find themselves in the headline news whenever they open up these boxes.
So they were able to address the poisoning. They don't think that that will occur as much in the future.
I'd say it's a work in progress from the conversation I had this morning with Melpo. I think that incidences of poisoning are dramatically down, and they have beefed up their ability to investigate cases when they arise. But I'd say they're not fully there yet. But Cyprus is undergoing the kind of upwelling of love for its own nature that you find happening, I think, all over the world right now. Like if you open the newspapers in Cyprus or you see social media, I see more and more of it now that we have this Cyprus Environment Foundation. There's this growing awareness that Cyprus has unique and fascinating nature and they should protect it. And that it, if it's well looked after, protects them. The wetlands play an incredibly important role in storing water for the dry summers, for example, whilst helping to mitigate flash flooding in the winter. So there is now a wetlands restoration effort happening in Cyprus. I think species reintroductions sound niche. I'm obsessed with the return of beavers to Britain and Europe. And I don't think it's a special interest. You know, I don't think it's an eccentricity. I think the reintroduction of missing species is both practically and psychologically totemic. You know, I think it's a hugely important part of our agenda.
I love that you're using the word totemic. And I think it speaks to that concrete connection that you're attempting to foster between people and the natural world. I mean, we obviously have it. We're just not aware of it. And I 100% concur that species reintroduction plays such a vital role in that. And I was curious about the vultures because I've spent some time in India, and of course their vulture population and scavenger birds was just utterly and completely decimated. Again, they weren't the targets of the poisoning. It was agricultural chemicals that did it, but it was devastating. I think they're beginning to rebound a little bit, but they're nowhere close to their previous levels. So I think the agricultural chemical in question was regulated, but I think that there's still problems with the habitat. So
yeah, I mean, India is a really good case in point. It's a veterinarian anti-inflammatory called diclofenac that caused the problem. And they would give this drug to their cows. And if one of those cows happened to die with the diclofenac in its system, the vultures that ate the carcass would then die themselves. And because one carcass can attract in 20, 30, 40 vultures, it didn't take long for a complete collapse in India's vulture population to take place. And then they dragged their heels about banning diclofenac. And even once it was banned, it was still being found in the system. And the result has been something like a 98 or 99% collapse in India's vulture population, which has caused a whole cascade of different issues, from a huge explosion in stray dogs and a massive increase in the number of people that are getting rabies and dying from rabies in India. I mean, really frightening statistics taking place all over India as a result of that. But also the cultural loss. Parsi people, for example, use vultures as a way of it's a burial rite. You know, you leave your body out, the vultures consume your flesh, and that is not possible anymore. I was in South Mumbai recently at a dinner that was hosted by a Parsi family, and they told me that now it's the black kites that are consuming the flesh of Parsis in those burial ceremonies. And black kites are far smaller. And so they carry off a finger or a toe or something, and then they end up dropping it. And so suddenly there are people finding like a human finger on their balcony in downtown Mumbai.
Oh my goodness.
But there are significant efforts now to build back vulture populations in India. There are very, very large aviaries now, captive breeding, and it's going to be a multi-generational effort, but it is underway. And India has got a pretty good track record when it comes to restoration of species on the brink. I mean, they're brave about it. They invest where needed. They have a kind of whole of society approach to getting it done. And the other challenge, of course, is to make sure diclofenac does not find its way into Africa, which it has.
I'm glad you brought up the cultural aspect, because I didn't want to be morbid, but I definitely wanted to touch on that. And I actually witnessed that poolside while I was in Mumbai. So it was when I learned actually a lot about what you just spoke to. So thank you for that explanation. And I marvel at the level of detail that you understand these issues. So I was, thank you very much for that. So getting back to one of the first things you said in your first answer, and that was about establishing this more concrete, less abstract relationship with nature, and this approach that you have by essentially funding grassroots and getting the entire community involved. There's something else that I think that I don't know if you're doing it consciously or unconsciously, but I think that's a part of that process too. And it's the way you're telling these stories. When you introduced yourself, for example, Ben, you know, you didn't give like a set of achievements or accomplishment. You told a story about your youth and about how passionate you were about the wild boars. And I think that we as conservationists, we kind of default to this rational analytical approach where we're hitting people over the head with data and with numbers and statistics, and we're trying to explain things in these hyper-sterile terms about our ecological relationships and dependencies on nature, but we're not really speaking to the heart. And I think that it's difficult for us to connect and to love the natural world unless we see others doing it as well. And that's what I love about the storytelling and the passion that you put into your communications around this.
That's very kind of you. I kind of think we need to shift the way we interact with nature on two levels. Now, I think we do need a kind of economic shift. You know, we do need that data-driven approach to figuring out what value nature provides for us. You know, and I understand, you know, how do you put a price on something which is inherently priceless? Well, the truth is we are already putting a price on nature. It's just almost always zero. And therefore, figuring out the quantifiable value of a mangrove, for example, in helping to protect communities from flooding and storm surges, in creating the sand on which creates the beaches on which tourism depends, in raising the little fish that spend their juvenile period in the mangroves before going out to sea and becoming the fish that people eat, all of that has an economic value. So I think figuring out the economic value of nature and talking in data and so on will lead to better decision making. And it already is. We're starting to see in this country a recognition that if you clear nature from the hills and fill the hills with sheep, you end up with flash flooding in the winter and a 3-month long hosepipe ban in the summer. You know, and if you allow wetlands and scrubby wood pastures and so on to naturally regenerate in these hills, then you end up with a lot of those problems disappearing. So I we do need that, but I totally agree with you that that's not the way to get to people's hearts. And I think we also need a spiritual shift. You know, we need to reinsert ourselves back into the miracle, if you like. You know, we need to rediscover the purpose of our emotions, which is really, I think, to be in love with the world around us and to take great joy from the world around us and to gear the whole of our society towards maintaining the integrity of the biosphere. Like I think we need both. I think we need both. But at the moment, we have a lot of the former and not enough of the latter.
I love the way that you just said that. I just want to call that out. I mean, I think reconnecting to that spiritual side and remembering that we're part of this equation. We are inherently, we're part of the web. And we talk about it in a few, you know, in quite a few of the conversations that we've had on this podcast, but there's this disconnect in human society that we are outside of that when really we're inherently part of it and we rely on these things. And so, you know, like you said, placing a value of zero on nature is absurd. It's wild. I mean, it's absolutely just crazy to think that that's what we do when we rely so heavily on these natural cycles for everything, really. I mean, I know Amy and I have had many conversations about that too.
But of course, it's no accident that 80% of the world's remaining intact ecosystems are in the stewardship of indigenous communities, for whom harmony with nature is not just a practical necessity, but it's also at the center of their spiritual and cultural lives. And that is something that was also a feature of early Christianity. And if you read the works of Thomas Aquinas and so on, you know, the Gnostics, you know, they found a deep connection with nature and they considered God to be eternal and in everything.
Hildegard von Bingen.
Exactly. I have a photograph. I have a photograph on my phone of a painting which depicts Hildegard communing with the divine in the form of an octopus with its tentacles transmitting some kind of energy or knowledge into her head. A kind of medieval drawing. And I wrote a book called "God is an Octopus." I saw the picture afterwards, and someone said, "Look," someone said,
"Oh my God, I have to see this picture. Please send it over email after this. I need to see this."
I'll do that. I mean, to talk about storytelling. I mean, I had it in mind for a long time to write a book, which would be a kind of roadmap for restoring nature in Britain, where I live. I had it pretty well structured in my head: a restoration of river systems, and rewiggling of streams, and restoration of wetlands, including the Great Wetlands at kind of Somerset Levels, and the Great Fens of Norfolk, and all these landscapes that have been utterly desecrated. And I suffered an immense personal tragedy in July 2019. I lost my teenage daughter in an accident, Iris. Iris was a little star, age 15, and it was really hard to come to terms with, and everything blew apart. But of course, I had no choice but to figure out a way, because I have other children and I have family that needs me. And I knew from the very first moment that I would have to figure out how to survive this. And of course, I found a deep, deep solace and meaning in nature very early on, like amazingly early on. Like going outside with a cup of tea in my hands and listening to the birdsong was almost the only thing that made me feel okay for a moment. And when a pair of beavers set up shop on our little farm in Somerset 3 months after the accident and started transforming a simple stream along the bottom of the valley into a kind of string of what looked like Japanese rice terraces, you know, it filled my heart with joy. So when I sat down 2 years after Iris died to write this roadmap for restoring nature in Britain, I knew within about 5 minutes that the book had to be the story of rediscovering how to live through connection with nature. So a very different book emerged, and it's called God is an Octopus. And so I was quite pleased when I saw the medieval painting of Hildegard with the octopus god tentacling her from the top of her head.
Well, I know what I'll be doing on Amazon right after this podcast, looking for that book.
That's very kind of you. It's coming out in America in May this year. Yeah, I'm coming to America for it.
Oh, very good. Well, stop by Boulder. Would love to meet you in person. So, you know, it's so interesting what you were saying about the grieving process too, and just connecting that back to our discussion about Indigenous peoples. So the Black Hills, where the 12th World Wilderness Congress will be, is sacred ground to the Ocheti Shakoin. And I think I intellectually understood this, and, you know, I'm able to practice respect because of that intellect, but I didn't really feel it until a few months ago. A mentor of mine passed away, and he was buried a natural burial in the Gila National Forest and on the border of the Aldo Leopold Wilderness Area there. And without thinking too hard about it, just moving through the process of grief, I realized that place is holy to me. It's holy to me because he's there. And I mean, I'm not deeply religious. So using the word holy is, and having that word come into my mind, is significant. And realizing that that is the level of connection that the Ocheti Shakoin have to the Black Hills, that this is holy to them. It's not just where they're connected to nature. It's where they're connected to everyone who came before them, and to where they're connected to their loved ones. And all of that resonates for them in that one place. Really, I think, began to shift, and I already have a good relationship with nature, but it began to shift my heart and my spirit and my soul in how I'm thinking about feeling and ultimately behaving towards the natural world.
Yeah, I similarly was, I was not religious. I mean, I was christened and confirmed as a teenager because it gave me a week off school, you know, on each occasion. And I, you know, I've always been respectful of religion, and I've always been drawn to the beauty of it and the kind of belonging that it brings to people and so on. I, on my father's side, I come from Jewish roots, but I ended up christened and confirmed. My mother is English. And I just knew I had a deep love of nature. And I might have even said to you, it's an intense hobby. You know, I don't know that I would have used language like holy or kind of spiritual connection. I didn't, I just knew I love nature, and there's enough magic for me here in what I can see and smell and feel. I don't need anything invisible. I don't need any mysticism or religion. And then the disaster hit me in my late 30s, and I, for a time, felt held. I mean, almost physically held by nature in ways that were very hard to articulate in words. You know, there's a bend in the river where I go and swim. You know, it's walking distance from my house. And I went down there 6, 7, 8 times a day to submerge myself in the water. And I would come out of the water into the evening sunlight and see the kind of shafts of light through the trees above my head, and kind of, you know, a frog's eye view, dragonflies, and the kind of humming of life, and you know, endless interactions happening all around me, kind of patterns on patterns on patterns. And I felt mesmerized and held by nature in those moments, such that they were the only times I felt okay. And of course, as I began to re-involve myself in the work of the rewilding movement here in Britain and Europe, I found a deep sense of longing and meaning and stuff flooding back into my life. And I began to realize that my connection with nature is holy, that I am one with nature, if you like. And so am I religious now? No, but I'm much more likely to use these kinds of words. And I have a loose idea of what God might mean, you know, that I may not have had before. And I think it's helping people to tap into that connection is the answer. You know, aside from using basic economic logic that my 5-year-old son will understand, you know, around not trashing nature because trashing nature causes us great harm. Aside from that, we need to reconnect people on a visceral level with nature. And you know, E.O. Wilson famously coined the term biophilia to describe the innate love that all human beings have for the non-human world. You know, and even those in whom it's very dormant, it's still there. You know, like the most snazzy London living, property developing, Maserati driving, testosterone fueled guy will pay twice for an apartment that overlooks Hyde Park in central London. You know, the parks are full of people. The sun comes out for a moment, and everyone's outside sitting in the grass and so on. And I think the lockdowns, you know, awful as they were for so many people, I think they reawakened something in terms of connection with nature, because people had nowhere to go. So they went outside and sat on their front porch, or they walked around trying to find that little scrap of wildflowers and birdsong that exists near their home. And so I think that reconnection of people with nature is our greatest challenge. And to circle back on where we started, that's why species reintroductions are so important. You know, if you can make alive for people the idea that there used to be white storks clattering their beaks and nesting on wagon wheels on virtually every village house roof, and then they were made extinct, but now we're bringing them back, and the boxes are coming over from Germany, and the birds are being released, and it's on the BBC News, and you can go and see them, suddenly people get very fired up that restoration is possible and that I'm part of this. And that's why rewilding is such an incredibly optimistic movement. I'd say that rewilding as a strand within the broader environmental movement has had by far the greatest success in mobilizing large numbers of people to the cause.
Well, people resonate with these kinds of stories too, and animals. And there's, I think, like you were saying, there's such power in reigniting that connection to nature, but also recognizing, and I don't know if I would use re-recognizing, but just opening our eyes to that connection of nature, because for so many, it's almost just kind of like you said, we don't think about going out into the park when it's sunny, but we just do it because it's just kind of part of who we are. And really taking the time to recognize that connection to nature is so powerful. And I think such a, not obvious, but sort of a great way to do it is through these rewilding stories. It's easy to not easy to have people connect to it, but it's a very wonderful path to have people connect to animals and to connect to these stories than when you see that they're very possible and they're completely doable on any scale, really. It's just depending on where you're approaching the, you know, the rewilding from.
Yeah, we have way more space than they'll have us believe. I mean, in the UK, 85% of the food that we produce comes from just 20% of the land. And the least productive 25% of my country produces less than 1% of the food. So there's a huge opportunity to expand vibrant nature in those places without causing a loss of livelihoods or rural depopulation. There's a just transition in farming in unproductive landscapes is much easier than in other sectors that are affected by the transition that, that the world is currently undergoing. Because in Western Europe and in Britain, native bovines, wild ox, which was known as the aurochs, and also European bison were very present in large numbers for a very long period of time. So the ecosystem has absolutely evolved to have these big, heavy grazers trampling and browsing and grazing. And in fact, they are the dynamic entity within those ecosystems that create these amazing shape-shifting mosaic woodlands that would have characterized great swathes of Western Europe. And of course, we killed them all off, but their domestic descendants fulfill a very similar role. If you put Old English longhorn cattle year-round out on the hillside, they'll do very similar to aurochs or bison. And so we need the farmer and we need their cattle, just in very low numbers. And that's why it's important that we recognize the public goods that are delivered by healthy ecosystems and that we reward those farmers for delivering those goods, in addition to the small amount of money that they'll make from their quality beef box scheme or whatever it is that they have. And of course, there are some parts of Britain and many parts of Europe that are remote enough that they could accommodate the actual wild grazers. And European bison were down to something like 15 or 18 individuals in 1900. There are now 10,000 living in wild herds across different European countries. We even have European bison now in the southeast of Britain in Kent. So it's there is huge opportunity for restoring nature, and it doesn't involve compromising food security or clearing people from the land or any of those things that the culture warriors will tell us are the case. It's entirely logical to do this, and people want it, thank goodness. There's a growing clamor in this country for real, meaningful nature restoration.
I know that as a part of the Wild 12 process, I've been talking with a couple of individuals in our U.S. Department of Agriculture about the potential of shifting food assistance when it comes to tribal nations towards establishing and maintaining bison herds, which are totally healthy, traditional form of meat, probably better than domestic cattle, and also helps restore the natural landscape. And there's already community groups on the Native American reservations that are doing this. It just needs to be done in far greater numbers in order to meet the needs of the population on the reservations. So this idea of shifting incentives to work at that nexus of human livelihoods as well as the needs of the ecology around us, I think is key.
Yeah, I agree. By the way, I from this side of the Atlantic, I'm staggered that the response of some leaders to efforts to restore bison in the American West. I mean, in Montana, for example, where the American Prairie Reserve are working with First Nation communities and also within state and national preserves to bring back bison. And Governor Greg Gianforte and also the Attorney General of Montana have been, as far as I can make out, waging a series of legal battles to try and prevent that from happening. And I find that quite staggering. I mean, there's quite a lot of enthusiasm in Europe for restoring some of these iconic species. And it seems like it's quite an uphill struggle in the US.
Yeah, Amy, what's your take on that?
You know, we're just, because at the request of our Indigenous partners, we're getting more into the bison space. We'll probably be assisting in the places where there are the gaps, so community education, both on the reservation and outside of it, and pulling together stakeholder groups into more organized associations to help increase the momentum for bison restoration. But yeah, it's strange to me that our diets here in the Western United States aren't based on bison. They're based on domestic cattle. And there's a whole lot of good that could be done. And you know, this idea that we should all be eating a plant-based diet and whatnot. And I don't disagree. I'm not a vegetarian, but I don't disagree. And that being said, I think that consuming bison is absolutely essential to restoring them at this point in time, because otherwise there's no incentive to shift away from domestic cattle and move towards bison. And I think in the Western United States, you should be eating the resources that are available in your area. And traditionally it's bison, which is actually a much healthier form of meat. So, and trust me, I've been experimenting with it. I've had bison lasagna and bison bourguignon, and it's, you know, it's just fine. There's nothing really different. No, but I think you're right then about rewilding. I think that there's almost like a longing when people hear that word. I know that I personally experience it. The idea of rewilding, it's like rediscovering something that's lost in yourself, almost like remembering a better way of living. And so I do think that there's a lot of power in that concept.
By the way, this idea of eating nature in order to restore it, I think, is a really important one. In this country, we wiped out predators in this country. So the keystone predator of Britain is the wolf, European wolf. We also killed off the lynx, European lynx, which is another hunter of deer. And the result has been a complete explosion in native deer, red deer mostly in the north, and roe deer, which are a little smaller further in the south, plus fallow deer. And there are some non-native deer like sika deer and little muntjacs that come from Asia. And the upshot is that they're hollowing out what woodlands remain, and they're preventing the natural regeneration, natural recolonization of trees in bare landscapes. And they're causing all kinds of road traffic accidents. Ticks are out of control. A lot of people getting Lyme disease. I mean, on almost every different level, crop damage, you know, we need to control deer numbers. And the ideal thing, of course, would be to restore balance to the ecosystem by reintroducing wolves. And I believe that it will happen in my lifetime. And I almost got sacked from the board of DEFRA for saying publicly that I thought we should get wolves back. Well, things have moved on a lot since then, because in the last 10 years, wild boar have returned, beavers have returned, which was seemingly inconceivable. Lynx will return, I'm pretty sure of it. And then I think in due course, people will come to accept the idea that we need wolves back. But in the meantime, we need to shoot and eat a hell of a lot more deer. And it's lean meat. It's healthy. And we've got food banks. We have people who are hungry. We're endlessly talking about food security. We need to shoot about 600,000 or 700,000 deer in this country just to keep a lid on numbers. But that's an enormous resource that we're not tapping into at all at the moment. So I couldn't agree more. Eat bison in order to get them back everywhere.
Right. And it doesn't just restore bison. Bison restore the prairie. They are the keystone species because of the shape of their hooves there and the way they graze. The prairie grasses cannot grow with European domestic cattle. And so if we want prairie and we want it at a large scale, we need to restore bison at a large scale and ideally find those interconnected spaces where the prairie begins to come back in a less fragmented way than it is now. So Ben, I love this part of the conversation that we're having, but I also want to get to a couple of other topics. I'm especially fascinated by the focus that you have through the Conservation Collective on grassroots efforts, but you also have experience working with the government in the UK's Department of Environment. And I was hoping that you could share a little bit with us about the insights that you have from both that experience working top down and also your experiences working from the grassroots up, and how that is shaping your environmental ethic and the types of solutions that you think are really feasible.
I was lucky enough to be put on the board of DEFRA, which is the UK government's Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, in 2018 by Michael Gove, who is a Conservative minister, very brilliant guy, unafraid of taking on vested interests and so on. And I quickly discovered that a government department, even a little one like DEFRA, whose budget is a kind of rounding error in the context of total government expenditure, it's a behemoth. You know, it's enormous. There are so many different corridors and people doing all kinds of things, and the accounts are impossible to understand. it's such a big organization that trying to understand it all will be a task that will consume all of your time there and you'll never get anything done. But I also discovered that if you pick very carefully the areas in which you want to involve yourself, you'll find some capable people who are passionate as well, and where working in combination with them, you can get stuff to happen, especially if the minister is kind of on side. Farming and fishing, let's say industrial farming and industrial fishing, have an unhealthy hold in most countries over the Environment Department. Yeah, typically ministers and civil servants are afraid to annoy those vested interests because there's some kind of a cultural, moral force field surrounding each one whereby the public is easily mobilized in their defense. Because the public thinks of farming, for the most part, as kind of, you know, the farmer's wife scattering corn for the hens and the happy cows looking over the fence and the pigs in the big barn and so on. And they think of fishing as Captain Birdseye with yellow oilskins on a little boat chugging in the blue sea. And of course, it's not like that at all. Now, the most fish caught in British waters are caught by multinational owned industrial fishing boats. So some of them are big enough that they can catch hundreds of thousands of tons on one trip. And similarly, farming interests for the most part in this country are represented by a union that only speaks for the big guys. And as a result, trying to get stuff to change within DEFRA involves a certain amount of fear for those who take decisions. That being said, we got some amazing stuff done because there was a certain amount of chaos that followed the decision of the British public to leave the European Union. There was a vote to so-called Brexit, and one of the things that we Brexited from was the European Union's Common Agriculture Policy, which looks a bit like the US Farm Bill. It's 55 billion euros a year handed out to farmers pretty much with no strings attached according to how much land they're farming. And of course, it creates a massive disincentive to let any land go back to nature, no matter how unsuitable for farming, because if that little patch of your farm, which is difficult to farm because it's wet or it's steep, if you let it go back to nature, the eye in the sky sees and you no longer get your subsidy. And hence, wild ecosystems have been converted to farmland willy-nilly. Well, we came out of the EU's Common Agriculture Policy and into a new scheme that I helped to design with Michael Gove and a bunch of people at DEFRA, which we call the Environmental Land Management Scheme. And it's the same amount of money, which is approximately £2.5 billion a year, except in order for that public money to be accessible to farmers, they have to demonstrate that they're delivering public goods, or more specifically, public environmental goods. So this is a revolution in land management in the UK. And we had a 7-year transition period, of which 4 years have now elapsed. So the shit is hitting the fan right now in terms of kind of in terms of radical change starting to take place. And those farmers who are up for it and who are open-minded and who are innovative are leaning into it. And others are screaming about a net zero scam and climate hoax and kind of culture war type territory. And you see protests taking place in the UK and beyond in Europe. Europe has its own farming protests for slightly different reasons. But the new system is progressive because if you've got land that's really good for producing food, probably you're profitable anyway producing food, and you'll continue to prioritize food production, and you'll get a bit of public money for using less chemicals or engaging modern technology, drones and soil sensors, and just farming better, regenerative farming, let's say. But if you're on land that's really unproductive and where food production is negligible and where you're completely reliant on public money for your livelihood, you will go whole hog to get as much public money as you can by restoring ecosystems in as grand a way as you can. And if you really lean into it, you'll end up in a much better place financially than you were previously trying to scratch a living with 2,000 sheep on a windswept hillside somewhere in the west of Britain. So it's enormously progressive, the new system, and it's going to usher in a completely different look and feel throughout the British landscape. Now, most of the north and the west and the southwest is going to go back to kind of incredibly naturally vibrant, scrubby, wildflower-rich woodland pastures grazed with native cattle and some pigs. And the east of the country is going to shift towards more regenerative but still highly productive approaches. And I think if it works, which it looks like working, I think it's something that we'll see replicated in the other countries of the world that subsidize farming. Because world governments, mostly OECD nations, hand out in aggregate $700 billion a year in farm subsidies. So if you make those farm subsidies conditional upon stewardship and restoration of nature and natural capital, you change everything. So I think for little England, to be more specific, because Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland have not yet announced to what extent they'll be following suit, little England is doing something really pioneering. And I think it's something that's going to take, that's going to catch the imagination and possibly take hold in other places.
Well, from your lips to the octopus god's ears, let's hope so. I know that one of the things I'm most paranoid about in our farm bill coming up here is there's this, currently there's something called local control, or that's being rolled back, but it's where municipalities and states can determine what types of environmental policies that they implement. And at the federal level, they're trying to preempt local control in the farm bill and just make the only arena for competition of these ideas the federal arena, which would be very difficult for a small town or county that wants to do things a little bit differently to try to advocate for change at the federal government. But yeah, that's fantastic. And I love that it's essentially utilizing competition and just shifting the incentives, but allowing people to kind of figure it out in pursuit of those incentives on their own. And that allows for a wide array of adaptation and innovation, I think. Is this something that you have witnessed in the implementation of ELMS? Is that what it's called?
It's called ELMS, and we're deep into the transition period. And what we've seen is a new farming representative body called the NFFN, the Nature Friendly Farming Network, emerge, which now has thousands of farmer members. And there's been something of a bifurcation in farming, whereby very large numbers of often younger farmers are leaning into this transition and developing a whole new regenerative farming approach on great swathes of Britain. And we've also got wilder approaches to farming on less productive land happening. So the innovation is phenomenal. And that was the whole purpose of this new scheme. But also, just at a basic level, why should taxpayers hand out money to a for-profit industry without getting some kind of public goods in return? If you're a conservative and you believe in free market enterprise and small government, which is what conservatives say they believe in, then this is a perfect solution. The problem with a lot of conservatives today is that they say they believe in those things until an industry that they like wants a bunch of public money. And then it's all about shoveling cash down the throats of coal executives to try and keep the coal industry alive. Or it's shoveling cash to industrial farming to keep industrial farming going in its current form. Or $35 billion of taxpayers' money is handed out by governments worldwide to industrial fishing. I mean, what's that about? The fish are running out. The last thing we need is more boats and more fishing. And so what do governments do? They increase the effort through subsidies. I think perverse incentives created by governments are one of the main issues that we have.
Absolutely. And you touched on another one too, when you were talking about the conservative movement. And it's this idea, I boil it down to principle versus authority. And I think the Enlightenment was supposed to get us to a place where we weren't relying on authority in order to form our own opinions and judgments. And we moved towards a more rational, analytical era where we could deploy facts in pursuit of principles. And yet we still find ourselves in this area where we have these loose ideologies with good principles at their foundation, and yet authority is still superseding our best intentions, I would say. I want to get to that too, because you talked about the relationship between conservative ideas and conservation. And you are the chair of the UK Conservative Environment Network. Is that correct?
Yeah, I founded it. I'm not tribally political at all. My brother was a member of parliament for the Conservatives and became the UK's international environment minister as a conservative. I suppose I lean conservative in a British sense philosophically, in that I'm nervous of the concentration of power, you know, whether that's in governments. I'm scared of big government, and I'm also scared of the concentration of power in very large corporations. I figure that concentrated power is destructive to nature. And I don't just mean wild nature, but also human nature. So I, in principle, I believe in localization and I believe in decentralized decision making. I believe in economic decentralization. I believe in smaller government. And therefore, I guess in the kind of traditional sense, that makes me a conservative. But more importantly, I was frightened with a long era of conservative government coming in 2010 that we would go the way of the United States or Australia and have a kind of culture war over climate and environment, whereby to be a conservative, you would have to publicly state your anti-environment credentials. And we managed to head that off. I created this conservative environment network with a bunch of others. Now, today we have 12 staff. We have nearly 150 conservative members of parliament in our caucus and a load more in the upper house and a huge number of 600, 700, 800 conservative councillors around the country in our councillors caucus. And we're a powerful force within the conservative movement in Britain. And we didn't only manage to stave off that culture war. Now, Britain's virtually the only country that I can think of in the OECD that has a pan-political consensus around net zero, for example. But we got a string of amazing successes. You know, our first big success was the Blue Belt campaign, which persuaded the UK government to declare a series of massive marine protected areas, no-take zones, around the last little vestiges of the British Empire, these tiny islands that exist in the South Atlantic, the South Indian Ocean, the South Pacific, Pitcairn, St. Helena, Ascension Island. These new Blue Belt marine protected areas add up to an area the size of the Indian subcontinent. And they're no-take zones, policed with satellites and by the Navy, and it works. And they're bringing new prosperity to the people who live in those places. So that was the first of our successes. We got coal phased out 25 years ahead of schedule. We got an Environment Act in 2021 that is one of the best environmental framework of any of the major countries I can think of. Agricultural subsidy reform, a whole bunch of stuff we managed to get done by having this caucus. It's been a little tougher in the last couple of years, let's say, and the Conservative Environment Network is now somewhat about holding the line. But I'm not tribal. I set something up that has definitely been useful, and I've put my back into it. And as a result, I'm somewhat pigeonholed as a conservative. But I set up the Rewilding London Task Force with London's Labour Mayor, Sadiq Khan, and I'm trying to persuade shadow ministers of the Labour Party to do a nature bill in their manifesto. And there's a bunch of loose ends that need tying up and a bunch of things that need to happen that weren't included in the last government's nature agenda. So I'm more than happy to work with anyone and everyone. And I don't like to pigeonhole myself politically.
Can you come to the United States and set up a conservative environment network here, please?
I've come across a few young conservatives in the US that are flying this banner. I met a guy called Benji Backer, who's president and founder of the American Conservation Coalition, for example. I don't know how big his organization is, but he has a big social media following and he's saying all kinds of good things and getting a lot of flack for it. And of course, there's quite a rich tradition in the past of conservatives in America doing good things for nature. I mean, Richard Nixon, of all people, established the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Endangered Species Act. Way back, Theodore Roosevelt really got the national parks movement going. We called teddy bears because Teddy Roosevelt gave protection to bears. So I figure that what we need is we need people from all parts of the political spectrum to be arguing over the solutions rather than denying we have a problem, you know, and I think that's kind of the place we're in this country.
You know, thank you so much for saying this. In fact, when I used to teach at the university and I started into my environmental policy section, I would start off the section with the same question every single time. Which political party passed the most important pieces of environmental legislation in the United States? And of course, the class was silent. They knew it was a trick question, but they could not bring themselves to say Republican. But it was. So the Republicans under Nixon and Roosevelt. And that, I think, hearing that enabled my students that leaned towards the right of the political spectrum to listen a little bit more to that section, because otherwise they just would have tuned it out. And getting back to your kind of more agnostic approach to politics and the point you made about tyranny, I think it's a really important one that needs to be underscored. And in fact, I think that there was Karl Marx and Adam Smith had more in common than people think, especially when it comes to their motivations to writing their thoughts on paper, because both of them were motivated by the fear of tyranny. Adam Smith just identified it as coming from centralized government, and Marx identified it as coming from the concentration of power in the private sector. And I think that if we kind of got to the root of that, saying, okay, yeah, we're concerned about tyranny, we just prioritize different sources of it, we might be able to find some more bridges and come together and trust each other a little bit more on working on those solutions.
Yeah, I agree. I think a love of nature can help dampen political polarization as well. I think it's a kind of thing on which all people can agree. You know, you in my social media feed, it's where I see significant agreement from people that come from very different political places. You know, it's the idea of putting beavers back into our river systems as a way of helping to mitigate flooding and drought and way of breathing life back into our landscapes. It's kind of pretty well acknowledged now that we should have beavers back, and it's happening. And you'll find people from the free market right all the way to the real socialist left all kind of agreeing on that stuff.
I think we have a little bit of a ways to go in our country, but thank you. This has been a great conversation. As a person who is really just listening in, I feel like I've gained so much insight, and it's really wonderful to hear both of you go back and forth on all of these things. So thank you so much.
This is the best part of my week, Ben. Thank you so much for having spent so much time with us today. We really appreciate it.
Well, it's been such a pleasure for me. I'm a big fan, Amy, and I'm so happy to meet you, Jackie and Julia, and thank you very much for including me in this.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Find us on social media through the Wild Foundation or through our website, wild.org. And hey, if you're feeling inspired, don't hesitate to share this podcast with those around you. And maybe even rate us on whichever platform you listen to your podcasts. We appreciate the support more than you know, and it's that support that allows our work to continue and evolve.